Okay, so let's get into the diploma. I want to come to this video there. And it's the second sutta which we're going to look at first of all. Yes. These are all the words of the great disciple as collected together at the first council a few months after the Buddha passed away. This is the Pali version. They are also recorded in the Chinese version in the Argamas. And there's some great research being done to compare the Chinese version with the Pali version. In most cases, the Pali version is the earlier, but in a few interesting cases, it seems that the opposite is the case, that the Chinese is the earlier. And as we go through a few of these ones, I'll bring this up here, and actually makes the sutras actually even clearer when we see the Chinese version, and it's almost certain the Chinese version is the more accurate. And there's actually one of them which is going to be coming up in the Summary of the Clock. And I'll bring that up before we have to get to that. But here we have the Savasana Sutra. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove and out of Indrika's Park. Why is it called Jeta's Grove and Anata Pindika's Park? Who knows the answer to that question? How many of you have been to that? Been there? Okay.
Prince Jeta's Grove, yes. Was by Anata Pindika.
That's right. And the old story was that Anata Pindika had faith in the Buddha, wanted to get him a monastery close to his home in Sarvati. So he's looking for a place and think, this Prince Jeta's Grove is a great place for a monastery, so he's trying to buy it off Prince Jeta. And Prince Jeta, I think, said something like, I wouldn't even sell it to you if you covered the whole place with gold. And he said, done. And apparently, according to Indian law, that was actually a deal. So they judged that he had to do that. So another thing they kept sort of cover the whole place. Now, those of you been there, that's a lot of gold. You have to cover the whole place with gold. And all except the three entrance ways. Prince Jeta said, look, this is just really amazing. There's enough gold here for me anyway, so I'll take the last bit. You can take the gold away. So from that time on, it was Jetavana, Jeta's Grove, and other things as well. So there he addressed amongst us, monks, venerable sir, the Blessed One said this, I shall teach you a discourse on the restraint of the taints, the arsenals. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, venerable sir, the Bishop of Pride, the Blessed One said this. Now, first of all, the taints. These English translations of Pali words are always a bit uncertain. And the word arsenals here is called taints, sometimes it was called cankers. Now the root meaning of the word is outflows. It could be inflowing, but for myself, the word has a far more useful meaning when you call it the outflows. Especially as a meditator, you know you have to go in, you go into the mind, and you can see sometimes the force which makes you go out into the world, out into the past, out into the present world, out into life, and out into thinking. And that you can feel that force which takes you out from the sort of beautiful, peaceful center in meditation. Why? You know, you get restless. And that force which is pushing you out, that is a very wonderful way of understanding the arsenals. The outflowing of your mindfulness from the center out into the world. Outflowing. So, that gives you an idea what outflows are. Here called taints, but now we'll present them as outflowings. Monks, I say that destructions of the outflowings is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and see. In other words, for one who's smart. What does one know and see? Well, who knows and sees what? Wise attention and unwise attention. When one attends unwisely, unarisen outflowings arise, and arisen ones increase. When one attends wisely, unarisen outflowings do not arise, and arisen afterwards are abandoned. So in other words, well, this thing called wise attention and unwise attention here, if you have wise attention, then the mind doesn't flow out. If it is flowing out, it comes back home again. Unwise attention means you might be very peaceful, but the mind flows out, And if it's already flowing out, it just carries on because of unwise attention. Causally, yeah.
So,
wise attention, the outflow stops.
So it becomes like the line of something that works among the various effects of the
vehicle. That's right, yeah. Come on to what these wise attention are and two moments. Now, wise attention and otherwise attention, the Pali words are yonisa manasikara and ayonisa, otherwise manasikara attention. And there is no reason why it says wise or unwise except in the context. And you've probably heard me say it before, and I found it very useful to understand the meaning of yonisa. It comes from the word, a very commonly used word, yoni, womb, origin. It's a very old sort of Sanskrit word. And what it truly means, manasikara, attention is fine, it's strictly means work of the mind. It's going to the origin, the source of things. In other words, where does something come from? Why do I think about this? Where does it originate from? So that you may have like a restless thought. Instead of saying, where's it leading to? I'm thinking about going home and having a nice dinner, and you can think of what you want to eat. You see, you're going out. Not to where these things come from, but the consequences of things. And that's the ayonisa. You find out the source of these things, and then things stop really quickly. Now that's giving a deep understanding of what wise attention is and unwise attention. Marks. There are arsals, outflows that should be abandoned by seeing. This is the word dasana. A much better translation of that would be insight. There are arsals that should be abandoned by insight. There are arsals that should be abandoned by restraining. There are asavas should be abandoned by using, by employing something. There are asavas that should be abandoned by enduring, you just have to put up with it. There are asavas that should be abandoned by avoiding them in the first place, and there are asavas that should be abandoned by removing. And there are asavas that should be abandoned by developing, by bhavana. I think many people understand the word bhavana, that cultivation, the training. So that's the summary. Now, one by one. First of all, this is the most interesting one at first. The asavas should be abandoned by seeing, by insight. And, in brief, I'll just put my summary in here. Asavas to be abandoned by insight, and the asavas will stop you being a sower or streamer. Those departments are abandoned at the point of becoming a stream winner. And this makes it quite interesting and quite clear. So what are the asanas, the outflows that should be abandoned by seeing? Here marks an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dhamma. Who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dhamma. Now that is a standard for someone who is not a streamer. So this is standard. It's an idiom, so if I was translating this, I would say for someone who's not married. And take out all of the extra words there, which have no meaning except to say that this is a standard description of someone who's putrajaya. Yeah. Indeed, so that's why it's confusing. It's the same as in English, it's raining cats and dogs. And you look outside, there's no cat falling down, there's no extra dogs in the monastery, it's just the idiom. And that's why that sometimes that people should actually not translate word for word, as Bhikkhu Bodhi has done here, but translate what the idiom actually means. Yeah, it means, it literally means, it's used so often, it's a standard word for a puja. And if you say this is a generalization, like a stereotype for each other, not all conditions are like that. And such a putrajana, you know, putrajana is like non-Aryan, not streamer. does not understand what things are fit for attention, what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he attends to those things which are unfit for attention, he does not attend to those fit for attention. In other words, you put your mindfulness in the wrong place. What are the things unfit for attention that he attends to? There are such things that when you attend to them, the unarisen state of sensual desire arises in them, and the arisen state of sensual desire increases. The unarisen arsenal of being arises in them, and the arisen arsenal of being increases. The arisen arsenal of delusion arises in them, and the arisen arsenal outflowing of delusion increases. These are the things unfit for attention that he attends to. In other words, here they produce the three arsenals. Here the sexual desire, being, and delusion. I prefer delusion and ignorance because there are professors who are still very deluded. They've got no ignorance, they know more pi than I do, and there are some even monks who can actually recite every page of the Tripitaka, and they're still not streamers. So ignorance, it's not really a lack of knowledge. Ignorance means a lack of knowledge. Delusion means something much more different. So I prefer delusion rather than ignorance. And those three arsenals, sensual desire. That again is an English word which doesn't give the full meaning to the karma arsenal. The karma arsenal means that the seeking for fulfillment, for delight, for happiness in the realm of only the five senses, the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch. It does not mean the seeking for desire, happiness in the sixth sense of the mind. That's very clearly made, a point very clearly made in the, the Arana Vibhanga Sutra. So if you look at that, and then you see the distinction between what sensual desire is, it is only applied to the five external senses. That's an important thing to understand. That's the arsenal of sensory desire. Basically, five sense desire, not the six senses. The arsenal of being, even when a person actually can let go or restrain seeking delight in the realm of the five senses, basically in the world, still, the very fact that I want to exist means to express your existence, to express your being by doing something, going out there in the world and being somebody. So if you actually go inside and you stay inside, one of the problems with meditation is basically you start to disappear. You just aren't anymore. So this is one of the problems of deep meditation. You are challenging your whole notion of being. And going against that thing which forces you into the world just to express your being. And I don't do anything, I'm nobody. This whole point of this practice is to be a nobody. And of course, delusion. Delusion is very well explained in the sutras by what the noble ones say is happiness, the Putujanas say is suffering. Like spending 3 months in a monastery. In the world, people think you're crazy. 3 months of just eating 1 meal a day, or 3 months of having to get up early. Why don't you sort of hang loose and enjoy yourself? Go to Bali. Have you seen the Amazon River yet? And what people say is happiness, the enlightened ones say that's suffering. Having sex, having babies, winning the lottery. People think that's happiness.
I say that's different. What is the knowledge of the human
being? Most of the Bonobo Foods and Anapas and a whole lot and Anapas. That's delusion. So, what they're saying here is whatever encourages and enhances those outflowings means you've been watching the wrong thing. Things not fit for attention. Now, of course, it's quite easy to see sensory desire, things fit for attention, little guys, beautiful girl comes in. Yes. What do you do when you see a beautiful girl? A lot of times you look for that part of her which is going to stimulate yourself. That's the usual way a person actually acts. If you like her hair, you just go to her hair. If you like her bosom, you just go to that part of the body. And my training when I was a young man, my wise attention was to try and find something in those young girls which was disgusting. I'll have to look for a pimple somewhere. And as soon as I saw some fault, some defect, then I was actually stopped any sort of movement towards lust. I was actually going in the opposite direction. And things which were deliberately trying to lower or lessen the lust. And you find actually, you can see the things are different attention. Beautiful woman comes in, what do you look at? Are you paying attention to the right place? Hunky guy, or whatever else? Or food which comes up? No. You might see some food which you really like, and you think, gee, I'm right down the bottom of the line, I hope you might go eat it all before I go. So that's unfit for attention. Well, again, this is training experience, you know that what type of perceptions actually are going to lead to more sensation desire. That's a big one. Now, the other two, they're really sort of subtle. How do you actually get rid of the idea of being and the idea of our delusion? And that is where the idea of like yoga samadhi kara is going to the source of things. Don't go to where it leads to. You know, what is this? Where did this idea of me come from? Go right to the essence of it. And delusion. Delusion is what happens when you look outside. As someone said, when you look in the telescope looking at the stars, that's delusion. When you look in the other end of the telescope and find out who the hell's looking, and that's where you actually go inwards. That's the right way of looking. So instead of like, what's out there? You know, who's looking? Instead of, oh, this happens and that happens. You know, who's actually doing that happening? What is this thing we call will and consciousness? That's where you go to the center of things. So pay attention to that. That's where the unarisen taint of existence or being ceases, and the unarisen taint of delusion ceases. The hard thing to do is actually to look in the middle of this. And are those things fit for, and what are things fit for attention that doesn't attend to? Actually, the opposite. Those things that when you attend to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire does not arise, and the arisen taint of sensual desire is abandoned. The unarisen taint of being does not arise. If it is arisen, it is abandoned. And the unarisen taint of delusion does not arise. And if it is arisen, it is abandoned. These are the things fit for attention, but it does not attend to. By attending to things unfit for attention, by not attending to things fit for attention, but unarisen taints arise and unarisen taints increase. Okay, so it's quite clear here. Well, what stirs you up? And if you pay attention wisely, especially with the sensual desire, that's the big thing, that's the one which goes first of all. So see if you can actually not pay attention to things which will stir you up and make your life more miserable. Whether it's sexuality, we stop all newspapers as best we can. There's always a few magazines in there. But don't stir yourself up by looking at pictures which, if you like cars, pictures of a new Ferrari or whatever else is in there. Now, if you do happen to drive the monks into town, you know, don't go looking at the shops and just seeing just, you know, what is the latest, whatever it is you want. But just try to calm yourself down by not paying attention to those things. And also sexual desire, also the opposite of that is when sort of you have ill will, which is part of the karma sutra. So if a person calls you a bloody idiot, what do you do? Pay no attention to it. Throw in one ear out the other, as I keep on saying. One ear is to go in, the other ear is to go out. So don't keep anything negative, don't pay attention to it. Anything which is going to stir you up, make you upset and angry, I just said it up. And that's not paying attention. The things which are going to just stir up the violence. There we go. Remember, people are the owner of their karma. So you don't have to take on board the stupidity, bad karma of other people. So there goes the past. That's also a wise intention. Unwise intention is dwelling in the past. Or dwelling in the future. That's also an unwise intention. That goes out. It's part of us. So be a wise intention in the moment. And there are other sets of desire. And actually a lot of delusion. And even one point, a lot of sense of existence disappears in this moment. Okay, this is how you became wise, unwise thing. Now this is interesting. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Who else is inwardly perplexed about the present now? Am I? Or am I not? What am I? How am I? Where does this being come from? Where would it go? Now that's a very powerful paragraph there. For a start, was I in the past? How was you in the past? Then you get a very clear sense, forget about the past. Forget about the future. And that's, you know, when you hear me teaching meditation, the first thing you do is let go of the past and let go of the future, because that's our wise case. It will be perplexed about the present. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where's this being come? Where will it go? That's the second part of my meditation technique. Shut up. Stop all this thinking. Because you know, you can't get to any truth by this unwise attention to thoughts like that. Because that just, all those thoughts, as someone said a long time ago, you think about something like a satellite orbiting a planet always goes round and round and never actually lands. So it goes to the centre of things. That's what thoughts do. They never actually get to something. They're pointed to something and actually never get there. Well, that's a beautiful little saying there by the Buddha about just stop all this dwelling in the past or dwelling in the future. We're in the present moment, but not with sort of this thinking. Now, when you attend unwisely in this way, with all this thinking stuff, then one of six views arises in the person. The view, self exists for me, arises in him as true and established. Or the view that no self exists for me, arises in him as true and established. Hang on, isn't that insight? There's no self? Now here we go to the problem with idioms again. You ask any of the monks who know this Pali, and these are the two views, the Ati view and the Nati view. The Ati view is of a soul which is there and permanent, you know, I am basically. It's like the soul view. And the other one, that no self exists for me, that's their way of saying their idiom, it's not anatta, that's where it's saying that the materialistic view. Yeah, there's no real being in here, it's just brain, and this idea of a mind is something created by the brain, and then you die, we all die, it's all gone, finished, nothing left afterwards. No rebirth, no sort of heaven and hell, it's just the end of things. Those are the two extremes which, in Pali, that's actually how they express this.
We do this once.
Yeah.
Do we do this one's philosophy?
Yes, right, yeah. So just one night, so screw everybody, get as much out of it as you can, and so see if you can get away with it. Because when you die, you're all the same. That's the no self exists for me. It's not the anatta, it is something different. Yeah, you know, it can be me, you know, I'm here, but after death, nothing. The other one, yeah, after death is me, the soul. Those are two extremes. And there is, for people who want to actually check that one out, that's in the, I think it's Pachanakota, Sutta, it's in the Samyutta, it's one of the famous ones. Because that actually gave rise to Majjhima philosophy of the so-called Mahayana. And there the Buddha said, like, I don't teach the Ati view, nor the Nati view. And I teach the middle way between those two views. depends on origination, cause and effect. He said, I can't say it is nothing, which is the second thing, because it's hidden arising and passing away, is there? And that arising and passing away, that causal process goes on after death. They can't say there is nothing, because the cessation is always seen. So the difference between a self, a soul, and the difference between nothing is this beautiful cause and effect process. A process without an essence to it. But not nothing at all, a process. And that's dependent on the measure. It is exactly annihilation. That's what it's talking about. There is no self. So death and we should go.
So presuming presence.
A presence self, yeah.
And that's why the error trying to destroy the self to the self.
Yeah, can't do that. Illusion. Delusion trying to destroy the illusion. And it becomes very clear with the next four, where it says, all of you, I perceive self with self. But me, seeing my soul. All of you, I perceive not self with self. See, I can see myself. I can see it. Me, see myself. All of you, I perceive not self with self, arises in him as truly established. All of you, I did the extra one. I perceive self with self, I perceive not self with self, I perceive self with not self. And of course, those of you who have been trained in the West, you know that of all those combinations, there is one missing. And that becomes very clear by its absence. The one which is not the wrong view is what? I perceive not self and not self. And that's what he's supposed to do. You know, with this process of anatta, of cognition, you perceive that there's no one in there. So that's the one which is left out. Which is because that's arising. And that's one's job, actually, to do this process of cognition, the five khandhas, you can actually see there's no essence in there. You're perceiving non-self in non-self. And that's the one which is missed out. For a reason. Or else he has some such view as this, and this is the common one. So the Buddha actually puts this last one, just the way that most people perceive itself. It is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and now the result of good and bad actions. But this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will endure as long as eternity. That's most people's idea of the immutable soul. And this is important, this self that speaks and feels. This is one of the places where I got this doer and knower business. The speaker, the doer. This is myself discussing, which speaks, not just with the mouth, but you know, with the mind. Giving the thoughts, the intentions. In other words, when you actually do something, you control your life, you manage, there's always a thought comes first of all, the inner speech, which is the tools of your self-government. You think, then you do. So that's the doer. This self of mine which does, and which feels, it doesn't mean just feels with the body, which actually knows, which experiences things. That's the knower part. And I would say those are the two main parts of one's idea of the self, the delusion self. Here you call it the speaker and the feeler. But it means much more than the speaker and the mouth, it means the doer, the active part of the mind. And the feeler is the passive part of the mind. So it's things like that which try to justify this doer and knower distinction in the mind. Because those are the two places where people think they exist. I am the one who decides to spend the legacy. I am the one who decides to come here this evening. I am the one who decided to put my hands up just now. I am the one who decided to start looking down in my book. I am that person. Or I am the one who can listen and know. So those are the things which the Buddha says quite clearly, that's wrong. And this self of mine, that particular self, the speaker and the feeler, or the doer and the knower, this self of mine, the doer and the knower, is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and endures on in eternity. This thing which does takes it in you. This thing which knows within that us. And the Buddha wound it up here. This wilderness of views, this contortion of views, and that's a beautiful sort of metaphor there. Because when you start thinking like that, you just twist yourself around just to justify it. Even though all the science and all of the psychology tells you, no, it's not you, but you tend to twist them and but somehow we just want to be. We contort ourselves, doesn't matter how painful it is, because we need to exist. That's our duty. This contortion of views, this vacillation of views, this fetter of views, I've missed out, particular views. It's so hard to get through this. This wilderness of views, because you just don't get anywhere with those sorts of views. So it's beautiful metaphors, I love those. This fetter of views called the thicket, wilderness, contortion, vacillation, then again you've done, fetter of views. And fettered by the fetter of views, the unsought ordinary person is not free from birth, aging and death, and soul lamentation, pain, and despair, is not free from suffering, simply because one has a view of self. And this actually goes to one of the fastest Buddhist views, you see. Yeah.
Okay, so can I all have this holding the outside?
Yeah, why do you have a mind? Well, it's because you do what you feel. That's right, and that's one of the problems is that when you try and stop these arguments, it costs. Because you can't do anything, and all your feeling, all your consciousness, you vanishes. You lose everything, you remember what thought you were.
And is this why right view is the first of the Eightfold Path again?
The first and the hardest.
Yeah.
But to get that right, there's no self in here any which way. Consciousness, self, the me, the thing, the nose, mind, whatever you call it, it's not me nor self. It's just a process. And this doer, which we feel so guilty about when we do things wrong, this doer feels so proud about it. I had a really good meditation session. Shit, I did it properly this time. That just happened. This, I did that. That is when you build up sense of the self. What you did and how you feel. Take that away, and then it's amazing that you're not responsible for anything you do. None of my business. It doesn't mean you get bad perfume because you didn't disappear. You can't make it happen. So, that causes suffering as soon as you have those views of the self. And because you've got a view of the self, somewhere in there, I'm one who speaks, I'm one who feels, then you will not be able to stop where you are. It would get you wrong. A well-taught noble disciple who has regard for noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in their dharma, who has regard for true men and skilled and disciplined in their dharma, in other words, an Aryan. They've seen themselves. They understand what things are fit for attention and what things aren't fit for attention. Since that is so, you do not attend to those things unfit for attention and you attend to those things fit for attention. What are the things unfit for attention? Those are the things that when you attend to them, unarisen and outflows of sensual desire, being, and delusion arise and increase. Those are things for attention don't attend to. What are the things fit for attention as Aryan attends to? They're the things that such when you attend to them, the unarisen arsenals of sensual desire, being, and delusion do not arise, and if they have arisen, they're abandoned. Those are the things fit for attention that you attend to. And by not attending to things unfit for attention, and by attending to things fit for attention, and there is an arsenal of not arise, and there is one to become abandoned. And just at the end there, sometimes when you have something like the engine, this looks like it might be an additive. No, this is to me anyway. Because it's not wrong, but it didn't actually fit with the flow of things. So you attend wisely. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the way to cessation of suffering. In other words, you put your attention on four noble truths. When you attend wisely in this way, three fetters are abandoned in you. Personality of you, which is what we're just talking about, Now, the idea is me being the doer and the knower or anything at all. It deals with rules and observance, doubts about anatta, about the wisdom of the Buddha, and adherence to rules and observances. That is the delusion in the time of the Buddha, even now, that just by doing ceremonies, initiations in Vajrayana, chanting of the name of Amitabha or something, just by doing those rites and rituals, that's enough to get you enlightened. And the same. When you have to see this, you have to get to the heart of things, the Yogis and Manasikra, to see it non-self. That's where it's become enlightened. So the stupid idea is that you just do rules and affirmatives and that's going to get you all the way. That's see-through. It doesn't mean you don't have any rules and observances, because the rules and observances, it's sila and vata. Sila is your precepts, your Mahāpātimokkha precepts, and vata is your duties. For those who have been here a long time, the Thai word for that is what. Well, we have core what. And the duties of a monastery, the things that you have to do. So we're not saying that you shouldn't do any duties, or you shouldn't have any precepts. It means you understand the place of the precepts and duties. They're important, but there's much more to it than that. That's the meaning of that understanding. So in other words, when you attend rising this way, the asavas which you're abandoned by, insight, are the ones which you abandon to become streamlined. So the three Sanyojivas have Sakaya Vitti, Vittikicca, and Siddhabhata Paramata. Those three fetters, self-abandoned. Then you're
streamlined. The group that's the rules, they seem to like support the suffering of the outcome.
Oh, yeah, they're important.
They're
necessary but not sufficient.
In the world, people try and impose duties and strategies, that's just a social thing. They actually
Well, in particular, I mean, most of the events of the beginning time, notice there was. There are two ascetics. One did the dog right, the dog duty, and the other one did the cow duty. And that was actually the sort of thing that the Buddha was pointing to over here. In other words, the ascetic doing the cow duty was it as a cow, hang out with the cow and eat grass, and go out on all fours. And the one with the dog duty would live like a dog. Trying to bark, hanging out with dogs, and just speaking with dogs and acting in all sorts of ways like a dog. And they thought that was going to be the path to enlightenment, which was a very upsetting and difficult thing to do. And even today people think, oh, anyone who's so ascetic, they must be holy. You go to India and you see all these holy men, people doing feces and stuff, and they think, just by doing that, you know, doing the feces duty, you're going to become holy and be in your life. You usually get sick. But anyway, the Buddha was going through town and the dog duty ascetic and the cow duty ascetic came up in and sort of said, ah, you know, you're supposed to be the same as us. You know, you're a great mind being, we're the mind to on the cow duty ascetic. And he said, what will happen to us in our future lives when we die? He put up to the cow duty ascetic, you'll be born as a cow next life, and you'll be born as a dog. Because it's a really difficult thing to do, and they've been putting all this effort into acting like a dog and acting like a cow, and that's just so much pain and suffering, and they realised they're just going to get reborn as a dog and a cow. And I forget which one was which, but I think the cow might actually still crazy for them, just walk away carrying on like a cow. And then the dog did realise he can say this change. I think actually he was only some month or something after this. He gave up his dog duty. That's a sort of the duty, which one of the things which the Buddha was putting on here, just by having these adherences to such observances, but that's enough for you. So that's the most difficult section over here, and the bigger section, the asavas, the outflowing to be seen by insight, and in particular here, focusing on the insight into the non-self. That's the most important one. Also, making sure the sensory desires involved in the world of five senses is not sort of restrained. That actually comes on to this one over here, the second one. There's an overlap. The article is to be abandoned by restraining. So what outgrowth might to be abandoned by restraining? Here I might reflecting wisely advise that the eye cut would be restrained. In other words, you don't go looking around all over the place. Here a monk reflecting wisely advise that the eye cut be restrained. While outflows, vexation and fever, vexation, the ill will, and the fever, the delight, and wanting, and craving, might arise in one who abides with the eye cut to be unrestrained, there are no arsenals, outflowings, ill will, and craving in one who abides with the eye cut to be restrained. So reflecting wisely, you abide with the ear faculty restrained, the nose faculty, the tongue, the body, and the mind faculty restrained, the whole six senses here. Because while the outflowings, ill will, and delights, fever of delight might arise in one who abides with the faculties unrestrained, there are no outflowings, vexation, or fever in one who abides with the faculties restrained. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by restraint. One of our faculties here. So we just restrain ourselves. We have all these sorts of practice. We mentioned about restraining the seeing, restraining the hearing. It's amazing that most of the conversations don't sort of relate to you, but you always like to hear. What's he saying? Is he saying anything about me? You pass by the kitchen. What are they saying? What are they talking about? Not even none of your business. So restrain the sense of hearing. And restrain smelling and tasting, restrain your food intake, and restrain your body. Sit still as much as you can. Mm-hmm. Restrain the mind as well. Stop speaking and fantasizing and planning and dreaming.
Do you know that a gradual mind rather than just a process of stress yourself? It's a matter of sort of like shutting down wanting and things and ritual and whatever, and sort of like appreciating the present moment. Can you simplify gradually?
Hey, basically, you say it's only present moment, so that's a restraint to the senses, special restraint to the mind. But also, you tend not to go looking at people, you can stir you up. Mm. That's why we don't have TVs in the monastery. If you are going to listen to some audio thing, then it's into a nice drama call. Mm. And just listen to Jimi Hendrix or what else do people like to do, you know, go do that sort of stuff. And if it's what's it, smells and tastes, you know, that you go eat strange, it's not that's a really easy one to explain to most people. And tastes as well, and they don't sort of get things really inflame you when you get your favourite food and you look at it, wow, it's really, really nice. How will it get fifty in my mouth? Oh, look at that beautiful pizza. If you really get sort of into your food like that, then sort of take food you don't like. So you're restraining sort of the fever, because sometimes, especially that in your first year in the monastery, first couple of years in the monastery, because all your other outlets for sensual desire are taken away. You can't watch the TV, you can't watch the music, you can't have sex, you can't do all these other things. The only sensory delight you have in the monastery is using your food. That's why the young monk becomes a huge thing for food. And also that with drinks or sugar or something like that, that becomes a huge thing. Way out of proportion. Simply because you can't enjoy any other thing. So that's sometimes it's good to restrain that. You really get excited when the food comes.
A mental component that is kind of often in there to try to develop awareness and gratitude. It seems that some of the it comes from context to the context itself, so okay, you know, appreciate you just for us. So that's why it's refraining the sense of still using it, I think.
Yeah, in a sense, yes, but again, I never fully completed the thing that you delight in the beauty of the mind, and that restrains the mind from delighting in the five senses. So if you are going to indulge in anything, indulge in the happiness of the mind, first of all. And then later on you can let go of the happiness of the mind.
So I think if you're trying to sort of develop that appreciation of the mind, there is a sort of an
impact. It never happens,
yes. Is it not the transition?
It is, in a sense, a stepping stone, because the mental happiness He gives the mind time to delight him. That's what we're concerned about, the world of perception. He makes what is make the world of perception. So we let go of the beauty of the mind.
Vexation is a special translation.
And I just said ill will and craving. Just that connected with like delusion and desire and ill will. The vexation, that's how we use words. Yeah. No, it says I'm really vexed anymore, so it's just off. So what takes our outbounds are to be balanced by music. So first of all, this strain of giving things up, this is actually what you employ, you get into. What asks was monk to be abandoned by using? Here a monk reflecting wisely uses the robe only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, and protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, swimming stuff, and keeping things, only for the purpose of pursuing the private parts. In other words, you use your clothes to keep comfortable. So please use a blanket when you come in here if you need a blanket to keep warm. So you're using these things, and then a lot of the difficulties in life disappear. So if you're not warm enough in your room, get an extra blanket. Put on the heat, because that's what you're supposed to do. Protection from cold and heat. Reflecting wisely, use your arms too, neither for amusement, no, it's not for fun, not for intoxication, not for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, only for the endurance and continuance of this body, in other words, keep it healthy. For any discomfort and to assist in the holy life, considering thus, I shall terminate all feelings of being hungry and without arousing new fears of being overeating. And I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. So again, you have to eat. So eat wisely. Not too much, not too little. Not because you enjoy it, not because you know you want to sort of look good, but just so that you can have a peaceful body which is not sort of hungry and not feeling in the
eating.
And
I think that's a bit sort of over the top.
Because it's only unlimited mindfulness when that's in later on, if an hour has. When you're a Christian, then you don't have unlimited mindfulness.
If you were starting to live in mind, yeah, but that's something to that man who is like
starting. Could be, yeah. It's true though. I know many people, there was this rishi who came to what Anachar was, and he didn't know especially second life. Look at the other was there, he was out somewhere, so I conceived him. And this guy had been in a cave for about 8 or 9 years. And people would leave food in the cave every now and again. And he was like a real rishi, big eyes and long hair, looked like a crazy guy. But really wild, really cool to see. He really was crazy. So he started talking to him, and this guy was out of his head, you know, literally. But in Thailand, anything was really weird like that. Like, wow, it must be an arahant. Just now, we were actually saying we can't understand what you're saying, but you know, he was a mad guy. So that the sentence is in the text can drive the place.
Is it the pain, the torture of the body that leads to that kind of?
It's not only that, it's yeah, just the lack of light view is really dull weird.
And what is the meaning of the pain of all feelings?
It means so that feelings of hunger, or feelings of weakness in the body if you haven't eaten well. Or it's not just the answer, it's like having some drinks and water because you're thirsty, like tea or coffee, even like a tonic in the morning. So you know, so you feel some sort of ease. And the stimuli of the guitar strings or the lute strings, just so those strings aren't too tight, not too loose. So you feel that you can meditate. And you find if you haven't got enough food, you know, you have lots of torpor. And that's one of the things which I noticed when I was in Thailand, because the food is so bad, not enough protein and vitamins, oh, it's a bit sort of tired and weak. You have good food, you get energy. Now remember, this simple thing, and the first is Mark Ananda. I said, oh, I really feel tired all the time. So can you give me some help and meditation I can do to get some more energy out? He said, eat more rice. So I thought, gee, I might not think of that. It's like a car. I didn't have enough energy in my gas tank. So I just increased how much more rice I ate. I don't think increasing the bar because rice is just right in the taste. And you think, I got my energy back. A simple thing like that. You know, I was actually, by not having enough staple food, my meditation was really taken off. So you've got to eat that right amount, you've got energy, but not too much energy. You have to sort of sleep too much. And reflecting wisely, you use your resting place only for protection from the cold, from protection from the heat, for contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, weeds, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of warding off the perils of climate and enjoying retreat, or should be really solitude. That's what we got to individual hearts. But the Buddha said it's for the purpose of solitude. We're not supposed to have people sleeping together or next door to each other, if we possibly can. So the ladies have got the rooms together, I'm a garagist. You know, I designed that, so you're not supposed to be able to see each other. You know, especially on Gallagher's quarters, and then you've got the walking paths and your own rooms, but they're on different sides of the building, so hopefully you can have to be almost independent of each other. And it's also for protection from the heat, of the cold, so that's why you use your heaters if you're cold. Not if you're not too much, and you sort of don't get really hot and sleepy, but just so you feel comfortable, that might be from middle way. So use those things. And reflecting wisely, we use medicinal requisites. I usually call them the tonics. Only from protection from arisen of thinking feelings of the benefit of good health. So the tonics make you feel you've got enough energy to feel good. While the outflowing vexation and fever might arise in one who does not use the requisites thus, there are no outflowing vexation or ill will in one who uses them thus. These are called the asuras that it should be abandoned by using. These are the four requisites of robes or clothes, food, lodging, and medicines. So we're supposed to use these things. That's what they're there for. That's what people offer them for. What people here in this monastery, lay, monastic or whoever, to actually use them wisely. And then all these ill will and outflowings, or sense of desire, so they're happy. Of course, the cats don't use these wisely, but nevertheless, they're cats, they're not human beings.
So, can the practitioner have that mindfulness of the ego with the upfronted treatment?
That's right, yeah. So, if you're getting more sense of desire, then maybe you're less. If you have more ill will, and see, this is sometimes people who do fast a lot. We're not old enough, we've got something like. They play his own, he's brilliant, he just knows the right amount, and it's amazing how he can release. But if you know, if you don't eat enough, sometimes you can get so sort of negative. So use them. Tends to be abandoned by enduring. What outgrowth might should be abandoned by enduring? Here among the taking wisely bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, and contact with gadflies and mosquitoes, wind and sun, and creepy things. Even in your heart, you always have some. Sometimes it'll be a bit cold, sometimes a bit hot. In the summertime, you just have to sometimes enjoy those things. If you can't do anything about it, just let it be. Just what it's like. And this is much more a better one. You endure ill spoken, unwelcome words. So I'm sure that will happen in the kitchen before the end of this race of the trip. So what should you do when somebody sort of gives you ill-spoken, unwelcome words. Enjoy it, don't react back, it's just life. It's no one can get away with that without being called a pig or stupid. So I just, okay, I'm going to enjoy it. That is why, if you enjoy it, then these answers don't happen to you. Or, bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing to life. Cover that from you, don't get that bad, but every now and again you've got cold or flu or something, just go enjoy it. Whilst pain, vexation and fever might arise in one who does not endure such things, there are no pain, vexation or fever in one who endures it. No will of somebody causes things, no desire or upset and her sick to this jury. Later calls the ask wisdom should be abounded by enduring. Now the ask wisdom should be abounded by avoiding. What are the ask wisdom should be abounded by avoiding? Here a man reflected wisely avoids a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull, a wild dog, a snake, a spark, a babble patch, a chasm, a pit, a cesspit, a sewer. And that's only some examples. Reflecting wisely avoids sitting on unsuitable seats. In other words, that's usually for monks hanging out with girls. Wandering to unsuitable resorts, in other words, going to places where you're going to sort of get sort of stirred up. And associating with bad friends, so if you were to do so, whilst preparing the hold up by suspecting of evil conduct. While pain expectation of fear might arise when it does not avoid these things, there are no pain expectation of fear might avoid them. These are called the pains that should be abandoned by avoiding. So sometimes it's good to avoid things. Another thing which might happen is if somebody has stirred you up, you've had an item of wisdom, just instead of just standing your ground and saying, who are you to say that to me, just walk out of the kitchen. Now avoid the conflict. Sometimes that's a better thing to do. If there's someone else who stirs you up with a lust, and when they come to the kitchen and they want to talk to you, you say, oh, excuse me, I've got to go to the toilet. Oh, excuse me, I've got something else to do. Just walk away. So you can get stirred up by this. And if you really like some food you really, really, really like, and really stirs you up, then avoid it. Put something else in the bowl. Whatever it is, so that way that there are some things which are worthwhile avoiding, say, no to. So it's not just avoiding the cesspit and the sewer, it's avoiding sort of things which are worthwhile avoiding. Sometimes what happens is after food, and sometimes you can stir up the senses and you start wanting to stir up the senses again. Or do something which is just sexual. And the ask was to be abandoned by removing. This is a more aggressive type. What ask was up by monk should be abandoned by removing? Here a monk reflecting wisely does not tolerate an arisen form of sexual desire. You abandon it, remove it, cut away with it, and annihilate it. So you've got like a fourth photograph. Alright, no, I'm not going to get involved in that. You're in trouble. You do not tolerate the risen thought of ill will. You do not tolerate the risen thought of cruelty. You do not tolerate a risen evil, unwholesome state. You abandon it, remove it, go away with it, and annihilate it. While pain, expectation of fear might arise in one who does not remove these thoughts, there are no pain, expectation of fear in one who removes them. These are called the pains which should be abandoned by removing. That's a difficult one because a lot of time if you try to be aggressive with removing these outgrowings, it creates more problems for you afterwards. So be careful with this one about aggression. If anything really gets really out of hand, and you have sort of sensory problems, and this may stop it, sometimes you have to have a bit more aggressive. More aggressive responses to when these things are really sort of getting a bit sort of over the top. But, even better than that, to improve them by doing some things, which are coming up later on, about things like substitution. So if you've got a chronic lust coming up, you do some reflections on the real nature of the body, and its unpleasant qualities. If you've got a thought of ill will coming up towards someone, then replace it by loving kindness. Yeah, I mean, they're just really awful, but I mean, they're not that bad. They're out of character, they're keeping precepts. So, by removing them, there's many ways of removing them. And so the aggression is only one way. And there's another, where's it coming? It's coming soon. Actually, it's further down, 13 or 14, about how to remove thoughts. Anyway, the last one, which is going a bit long today. The ask was to be abandoned by Bhavana. What outgrowing monks should be abandoned by Bhavana, by developing? Here a monk reflecting wisely develops the mindfulness enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassionate cessation, and relaxing relinquishment. He develops the investigation of Dharma's enlightenment factor, the envy enlightenment factor, the rapture enlightenment factor, the tranquility enlightenment factor, the stillness enlightenment factor. I never call that concentration anymore, stillness, samadhi. And the equanimity enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion and cessation, rather than relinquishment. These are the seven bodhanga, the seven leaves of enlightenment, factors of enlightenment. And the nice thing about this is when they are, most of the times they're described in the sutras, they always say which is supported, or rather rest is caused by seclusion. Yes, by viveka. And see how much you understand the Buddha's teaching. There are two types of viveka. What are those two types of viveka or seclusion? The types of notice. The two awakens? Kaya. What is Kaya awaken? That means going back to your room and staying by yourself, not associating with others. That's the seclusion of the body. And what is Chitta awaken? Dharmas, that's right. They're supported by these things, by physical seclusion, also this mental seclusion as well. By dispassion, by cessation, things disappear. And it ripens, you just you let go of everything. So those beautiful things about the enlightenment factors, you know, they're not sort of apart from the practice of meditation, but they're supported by it.
With the stillness of samadhi, what is the difference in tranquility?
Tranquility is not as evocative as stillness. If you think of stillness, you can think of like a lake of water, perfectly still, not a ripple, not a wave in it. So tranquility leads to stillness. Stillness is something which is far more evocative. You go out in the morning, nothing is moving, no sound, everything is perfectly still. That gives you a more feeling to what in samadhi says by dhyana or life. Absolutely still, nothing moving, nothing happening. So stillness is a much better word. In English word anyway. Concentration evokes concentration camps. It evokes when you're at school, teacher told you, concentrate more. This is created more like effort and stress. And that has a meaning which is totally alien to what samadhi truly is. And this is sometimes when people call it concentration, sometimes people actually force their mind to think that by using effort they can get into samadhi. Understanding stillness means how can you get a lake of water still, even alone? It becomes still by itself. It's quite clear when you understand the samadhi stillness that letting go is the only way to become still. Concentration, force is the concentration. Stillness, you have to let them into it. That's why stillness is a far better translation for the word samadhi. Okay, and the conclusion. Monks, when for a monk the taste should be abandoned by insight, being abandoned by insight. When the asanas should be abandoned by restraining, have been abandoned by restraining. When the asanas that should be abandoned by using, have been abandoned by using. When the asanas that should be abandoned by enduring, have been abandoned by enduring. When the asanas that should be abandoned by avoiding, have been abandoned by avoiding. When the asanas that should be abandoned by removing, have been abandoned by removing. When the asanas that should be abandoned by developing, have been abandoned by developing. Then you are called a monk who dwells restrained with the restraint of all the fates, all the asanas. You have severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit, you have made an end of suffering. What do you mean, penetration of conceit? I am, and also, I am better, I am worse, I am the same. You know anything, you just don't exist. But that's where the three conceits, being better, being worse, being the same, all disappear. Now interestingly here, I'm going to point this out because this is not just teaching the Dharma, it's teaching how hard it is. Look at this here. When the asanas that should be abandoned by restraining have been abandoned by restraining. Basically it says in part, the restraining asanas. or to be abandoned by restraining arms, which is one word, have been abandoned by restraint. How else would you abandon the restraining arms except by restraint? This is the idiom of power. You could broom sweep in the broom. You dishwash dishes. You you do body contemplation on the body. This is actually for those of you who know the Satipatthana Sutta. When it says body contemplation of the body, it doesn't mean anything other than just do body contemplation. It's just the idiom, in the same way you have here. The tenses should be abandoned by restraint, have been abandoned by restraint. There's a repetition in Pali, which we don't have in English. You bus ride on buses. You feet walk with feet. How else do you do foot walking except by foot? This is the Pali version. The reason I point this out is because some people, when you get to something like a Satipatthana Sutta, they make this, you do body contemplation on the body, or in the body, and they make something out of that which is not meant in Pali. A Satipatthana just means to do body contemplation. Nothing more than that. It's just the idiom for Pali. And you can see it beginning, even the first sutra read out here. A repetition, which if we were writing it in English, we would have. Okay, so that is the Savasana Sutta. Another point to be noticed here is the first of these methods, abandoned by insight, leads you to be extremely nice. The last one leads you to be the four arahants, depending on the enlightenment factors. That's what the Bhagavad Gita is. It seems these ones in between can be done before being a stream winner, often done after one is a stream winner. It's almost like a whole party. First of all, get rid of the sense I am and become a stream winner. And then after you become a stream winner, then you actually can restrain the senses. It's very difficult to do so beforehand, basically because your sense of I won't let you. Once you have seen that sense of self, it's easy to sort of explain the senses, it's easy to endure, it's easy to avoid, to remove, to develop, and to remove, and also to develop. Without removing the sense of self from the place, you cannot abandon sensual desire. It has to be done stage by stage. So you can do sensual strength, but it's not going to be totally successful until you complete the sin in the non-self become streamer. So if you haven't got total self-restraint, don't worry about it. That's part of the course, that's normal. Do as much as you can, it won't be perfect, and that will weaken the defilements enough for you to see myself. And once you see myself, all the other ones become very easy.
So, is that where the ASL comes in?
Yeah, ASL comes in everywhere, and most of you have don't be so hard upon yourself. If it's nothing to do with you, just on this bus journey, all go to the same stuff. They don't think, oh, I'm terrible, I'm not. But it's not actually to thin out, you know. It's great if you get people like maybe Adeniana or people who've known me a long time, back in December, because you get all my old mates, you know, coming here for the WAC, the West Australia Study, the West Australia, the World Atlas meeting. And these people knew me when I was a young monk. But when they come, you get all the old stories. What I really was like, and you found it as stupid as anybody else. Probably more serious. And it's great to have a food, because otherwise people think, oh, you were born. You know, you were born in Jaya. And I think you've been there for over a year. So you know, when I was seeing all these old monks, when I remember, especially making all these other monks when I was really young, they were really stupid. Crazy people. This is a path. We all start off at the same place. Then you practice more and more, you develop and become wiser, more peaceful, and more
strong. One of the things about the aspect of forgiveness and learning, to restrain the outflowing, too much too.
Yeah. Indeed. All right, then you can do for anything to affect yourself. So, no, you just forgive it, put out from it, that undermines the sense of self as well. Okay, so that's the first of these. It's one of the longest ones, so please apologize for taking a long time this evening, but it's an interesting one.